The idea behind body condition score is it really gives you a good indicator of your nutrition program. And the idea is that we know if a body condition score is related to reproductive performance. And so the idea is how can you basically manage cows so that they're at a specific body condition as a group at the time of calving for spring calving cows. And so the system that we use is a 1-to-9 system, and 1 is thin and emaciated, and 9 is a very fat and obese animal. And you don't see very many of those, okay, that spectrum. But as I drive up and down the road, 3 to 7 is probably what I see. And the idea is that not only can body condition score be related to reproductive performance, it can also be related to what happens at the time of calving.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lalamond Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm Travis Molinix, and today I have the pleasure of having Dr. Rick Rasby with me. Rick, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here and good to see you, Travis. Been a long time.
Has been a long time. So, Rick, you're back in a faculty role at UNL. Was a beef extension specialist for, what, 25, 30 years?
Let's not tell them how many years, okay, Travis, because we're above 35.
So a wealth of knowledge and experience, especially when we talk the topic of cold weather and managing cows for condition score and getting ready for winter weather, which I assume you've already had a little bit by your hat.
Yeah, a little bit of weather, but we've been pretty good so far, you know.
Good. So I'd like to start out with, for the listeners, just to give an overview of your career of, you know, how you got where you are and what do you do?
Yeah, Travis, that's a good question. And man, it's kind of fun to reminisce where you've been and where you're at right now. And so I went to junior college out in North Platte and played a little baseball there and then came to University of Nebraska and in animal science, pre-vet option. And I had really good grades, but didn't get into vet school, which was probably a blessing in disguise because there's a lot of connections between our faculty here at UNL and the faculty at Oklahoma State. And so I got into reproduction and reproduction class, and I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. And the kind of interactions between nutrition and reproduction. My advisor was Roger Johnson, who's really well-known swine breeder. And he said, I got a connection in Oklahoma. And I went down there and I remember I accepted a graduate program there and come to find out my advisor was going to go on a sabbatical. And, you know, I was going like, well, really, I didn't know what a sabbatical was at that time, right? And I go, this is really going to be messed up. But it worked out really well. And went to Oklahoma State, worked with Dr. Bob Wedeman. I was married prior to the time that we went down there. And I remember going down there and we were looking for a place to live. And that was the summer that they had the most days over 100 degrees. And my wife says, I'm not staying here long. I said, I'm not either. And so, but 6 years later and two kids, we had the opportunity to interview for some positions. And one of those positions was here at the University of Nebraska. And I was fortunate enough to get that. Early on, I was involved with the IRM, Integrated Reproductive Management, but we called it Integrated Resource Management because the number of things that impact reproduction, it's just not about reproduction. And so I worked with 9 herds across the state. And that really took me from being pretty good as a bench lab person to say that, man, there is this integration and these systems are really important. And I didn't like extension at first, to tell you the truth, because it wasn't like doing the bench work, right? But all of a sudden, when you get relationships built and trust built with producers out there, the puzzles become more difficult to put together. And I really enjoyed the idea of helping producers put together puzzles to help them find solutions for their operations. And understand, you and I both know that these things are, every ranch is different. And so the idea is that all of a sudden it became a huge challenge. And that's when I really started the Like Extension. And so that's kind of my path and been here ever since. And I do a little bit of teaching right now. I teach in the Beef Scholars Program, really enjoy that. So students come into the Beef Scholars Program as freshmen, and they have a passion for the industry. So the idea is, how do you get from learners to leaders in the industry? And so I enjoy the teaching part of it and have a little bit of research, but still a pretty big extension appointment.
Speaking of the Beef Scholars, and extension, from the complexity of the problems we deal with, is the Beef Scholars is a great program for students to see the complexity and think through those systems, right? Because it's not about nutrition, it's not about reproduction, and it's a system that they have to think through.
Yeah, and the other thing is they start to build a network with them, with that cohort, and then you give them opportunities to start to build networks outside of the university system, not only within the university system, but outside the university system. And you and I both know how important those networks are as we delve into our profession.
They're very important. So I think that's one tremendous program that UNL sets itself apart from a lot of universities, is the Beef Scholars Program. So let's get to the topic at hand and talk about the importance of body condition score. You know, it's winter, we're moving into some colder weather. You've had some cold events yourself. And for most herds, spring calving herds, we're past weaning, and body condition score is a very important process and management tool for producers. So let's talk about the importance of it. Why do beef producers need to know body condition score and manage for it?
So Travis, I think the idea behind body condition score is it really gives you a good indicator of your nutrition program. And the idea is that we know if a body condition score is related to reproductive performance. And so the idea is how can you basically manage cows so that they're at a specific body condition as a group at the time of calving for spring calving cows. And so the system that we use is a 1-to-9 system, and 1 is thin and emaciated, and 9 is a very fat and obese animal. And you don't see very many of those, okay, that spectrum. But as I drive up and down the road, 3 to 7 is probably what I see. And the idea is that not only can body condition score be related to reproductive performance, it can also be related to what happens at the time of calving. So there's some old data out there from Colorado State that Ken Oldie did that basically says that, cows that calve in thin body condition, if you take a look at the immune globulins in those calves after calving, 24 hours after calving, thin cows, those calves have less immune globulin as compared to those that calve and a 5 and a 6. And so it not only impacts what happens at the time of calving, but also impacts what happens during that next breeding season. And so the idea is that cows calve thin, typically they have a longer postpartum interval, right? And so they get bred later in the breeding season. Hopefully you don't feed them out of a pregnancy, but young cows, you can do that if you're not careful. And so body condition, and I would say that there's a lot of material out there, and I would have producers make sure that what they call, what we call a 5 is what they call a 5. Because sometimes you can be a condition score off. I was at a producer one time and I knew what I asked them to feed, and I knew that they should be gaining body condition, and they weren't. Well, the condition was lower, but he was calling a 4 or 5. And you can see now we have a problem, right? And so I would say that there's a lot of materials out there to take a look at that 1-to-9 system. But I'd have you really take a look at, especially on March calving cows, is to have cows and on the average, that cow herd condition score 5. But that means that there'll probably be a few 4s, right? And there'll probably be a few 6s, but the idea is have most of them at a condition score 5. I always say, and have producers think about having first calf heifers just a little bit more condition on them. And I usually ask them to shoot for a condition score 6 for first calf heifers. That means there's going to be just a little bit of fat around that tail head, and you can't see the 12th and 13th rib. But the idea is that is that they're lactating for the first time, right? They're trying to get the reproductive tract repaired to get bred for the second time. And the other factor is that they're still growing. And so the idea is that have them just in a little bit better body condition so that they have an ample time or at least an opportunity to get rebred. If you're going to challenge them, to me, Travis, you challenge them before the first breeding, right? Right. Once you get them pregnant, then the challenge is over. The idea is, how can I make sure that they stay in the herd for a long period of time?
Yeah, and that's very important. And, you know, that first calf heifer, you know, she has a lot of challenges. And so giving her that extra condition just helps her give that head start that she's going to go through some challenges in her first lactation.
Yeah. And, you know, Travis, sometimes people will say, well, I don't want to have heavy calves.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea is that you don't feed heavy calves out of a first calf heifer. If you don't feed them, you feed them out of the next breeding season.
Right.
Okay. And so the idea is that there's a lot of other tools that you can make sure that you reduce dystocia, right, in first calf heifers. There's more tools today than we've ever had. But just don't use the idea that I don't want to feed them because I don't want heavy calves.
And that's, you've got to get very heavy before you start having dystocia issues.
Yep, I agree. And the other thing is that it's almost like it's an environmental by nutrition interaction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is, you tell me if you can tell me the weather, then you probably don't need to be in this business right here, right? You need to be making money somewhere else.
Right. So what's the important timing? So when you think of body condition score, when should a producer, you know, look at body condition score and make management decisions off of it?
Yeah. And, you know, I think the easiest time is to do it at weaning time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not very good at it, that gives you a chance to feel them too, right, when they go through the chute. But at weaning time, and I don't do much. I just take and record a condition, right?
Yep.
And I would pay particular attention to young females, because
yep,
they're the ones that are going to be probably thin at that time. So the idea is to do it at weaning time. Probably not going to do much at that time, because I'm probably going to go back to some kind of feed resource. The other idea is that once you reduce lactational stress, I mean, requirements go down really low, okay? And so I'm not going to do anything, but really pay close attention to young females at that time. And if you really have things synced up for mature cows, is that you'll have mature cows that are going to be a little bit thin at weaning time, and they should be, right? Because if they're doing a good job of raising that calf, but within 45 days after weaning, you should start to see a bounce in them in regards to body condition. First calf heifers, it may be just a little bit longer, but that's how I do it. I do it then. And then I probably take a good look probably 60 days after weaning, and then the last time that I have a chance to change body conditions probably about 90 days prior to calving. And the reason why I say that is, if you butt it too close up to calving, then you got to really pour the grocery stuff.
Right.
And you don't want to do that, right? So the idea is that if you need to change body conditions, think about doing that by 90 days prior to calving. Yeah, like I said, if things match up right, maybe the only females that you got to do a little bit of supplementation on might be the first calf females, right?
Right.
And you sure enough want to have them in adequate body condition prior to calving. Right. In the second calvers.
I think you touched on an important thing, is you said touch them and at weaning time. And even people that have a good feel for body condition score, you know, if they don't calibrate their eye, then they can be off. And that's going back to your statement earlier about the producer that was calling, you know, a 4 or 5, is that it's easy to for someone that doesn't body condition score often to have that miscalibration. And when you touch them, you take out some of those components that add that variation, right?
Yeah, the idea is, how do you get past hair, right? How do you get past hair? And the other thing is that how do you get past muscle?
Yep.
Right? I tell you what's a dead giveaway is, you get a cow on corn stalks this time of year and you get some moisture and all of a sudden that hair is matted down and you go, oh my gosh. You it's almost like taking the hair off of them, right?
Yep.
You can really see what body condition is. But I agree with you, Travis, is that if you can run them through and kind of calibrate the hand with the eye, especially early on, it makes it a lot easier. The thing is, you don't have to be exact. Mm-hmm. You just got to be able to tell thin ones from ones that are in the right body condition to fat ones. And we never want to feed to be into sevens. If they graze to a 7 or cows to a 6, I mean, you're okay with that. But if you feed them to that, you're probably, it's going to be an expense on your enterprise, right?
No, that's a great point. The numbers really don't matter. It's being able to say, I have thin cows, they're too thin, I need to do something. My cows are in good condition, or they're too fat, I need to back off.
Yeah, and the idea is that if the fewer number of groups that you have to manage, especially in wintertime, the better off you are, right? And to me, you sure enough need to make sure that especially after calving, first calvers are separate from the mature cows because they're going to need some different groceries, right? Especially energy-wise. But if you got to continually feed mature cows prior to calving to get them back into condition, something's not quite right. You need to ask yourself, do these cows actually fit the environment that I'm trying to raise them in?
Right.
Because we got to make sure that if you want to be profitable, you got to make sure that you get them, keep them grazing as long as you can and get them in the right body condition. And so if that continually happens, you got to ask yourself, are my cows getting too big or have I added too much milk? And I'm not saying I'm against either of those two, but remember, Travis, you talked about this a lot. You got to fit cows to your resources.
You do.
You don't, it's expensive.
It's easy to get away from yourself too.
Yeah.
And that creeps up on you. There's that creep that happens over time and it hits you. My cows are too big. I've got too much milk. And it didn't happen overnight.
No, it doesn't happen overnight. And the other thing is that if you're there every day, it's harder to see.
It is.
You know, but if you have someone come in from the outside, you go, oh my gosh, these cows, you know, we need to go back through and see what that breeding program looks like and stuff like that.
Yep, that's a good point. So you touched on feeding first calf heifers and separating. Why would you want to separate those first calf heifers?
Well, one is that you don't want to have them compete with mature cows.
Yeah.
And if you don't have enough room, they'll not be able to compete. And there's a pecking order, right? And you don't want to get into that kind of thing. The other thing is that when I take a look at most rations and most that I put together for first calf heifers, you're almost going to have to be in the somewhere to low 60% TDN. I think we do a really good job on the protein side. I mean, we've probably hammered on that for how many years, but I think we do a pretty good job. I think where we don't do a very good job is on the energy side, especially after calving. And so sometimes you can basically get cows by, especially March calving cows by, with some really good quality forages, if you will, that will get them into the high 50s, low 60s on TDN. But on first calf heifers, you almost got to give them just a little bit of energy from something else. I don't know if it can be a little bit of corn. It can be a little bit of distillers in our country. It might be even a little bit of silage, depending on where you're at. But the idea is that they will need some extra energy. And the idea is that you can't let them fall between the time of calving and the time that you put out the bull for the breeding season. You want to make sure that they're at least maintaining. It's not important that you get them on an increase. A lot of times when you hit grass, they'll be on an increase.
Right.
But you want to make sure that they don't lose weight. Because Dave Lawman's got some really nice work that says, man, if you lose between calving and breeding, that reproductive performance is not going to be very good for the first calf heifers. And so that's the primary reason, Travis, is they can't compete and they need extra energy. Bottom line.
Yeah. And for a lot of producers, that's a challenge because the numbers, right? And so how do you deal with the smaller producer that I don't have the pastures, I don't have the additional space, but I have those, you know, first calf heifers with mature cows?
Well, you almost have. So to me, you overfeed the cows. You overfeed the cows. And the bottom line is that you got to give enough space.
Yep.
Right. So that the first calf heifers can be bumped around. Okay. And they still get their fair share of what they need. So that's the tough part is if you don't have you hit the nail on the head, Travis, you don't have the space, then you basically got to feed towards the young female.
And that's what I always tell producers is that you feed the highest requirement.
Yep.
And it's a challenge sometimes because you're going to overfeed some females. And the same way if you have a mix of cows that calved and cows that haven't calved yet.
Because if you err on the other side, you just can't afford to have a lot of open cows.
You can't.
You just can't. It's a drag on the system, and it's really a drag on the system if it's the open cow is one that you're trying to get bred for the second time.
Right.
Because she only has herself as a cull and her calf to pay that whole bill, right, that she's accumulated over, a year and a half to almost 2 years.
Right.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work.
It doesn't. So another great resource that you guys have that had been underutilized for a long time that it's a tremendous grazing in a winter time is corn residue.
Yeah.
And something that's picked up and you have kind of helped push that and from extension and get producers utilizing more and more corn residue. But talk about the benefits and how that really changed beef production, especially in the Midwest, of utilizing corn residue.
Yeah, I tell you what, Travis, we talked about this early on in this session, is that keep them grazing and you probably have a best opportunity to be profitable. And I would say, even though we have high calf prices right now, we have high input
We
costs.
do.
And at least in our area, is that, we have sand hills and they're just unique. And but I think the way that we keep costs down is in the wintertime, especially when you get to be when you get to use crop residues. And primarily it's corn stalk residue. And so that's one of the ways that we can keep feed costs down. And the interesting thing is that we learned that cows are selective grazers when they graze crop residues. They'll take the corn, followed by the husk and the leaf, and finally the cob and the stalk. And when I first started extension, there used to be at least 5 bushel of ear drop out there. I'd say unless you have something helping during the growing season or late in the winter or late in the fall where you get some down corn, you hardly have any corn left out there. So it's pretty easy to pick up a condition back in the old days, if you will. But I would say even with husk and leaf out there, that's a pretty good feed resource. And you got to remember that cows are selective grazers, right? They'll go corn, husk and leaf, and cob and stalk. What's interesting is that's you take a look at the nutrient profile, that's a nutrient profile. It goes from highest to lowest, right? So the idea is that they'll select corn first if there's some down corn, especially if you have experienced corn stalk grazer, then husk and leaf and cob and stalk. And the idea is that the husk and the leaf almost look like an above average quality grass hay. And so the idea is that you get them out there. If you have open winters, Travis, it's great. If you get shut in, then it's not a very good deal. But we've probably been out on corn stalks now for a month and maybe even 45 days. And so we've got cows out there that are March calving cows that are, picking up in condition. Young cows out there, one of the producers I work with at weaning time, we separate the young females from the matures. And if they go to corn stalk, they go to different fields. And the idea is if we got to pick a body condition, I don't have to sort them out, right? So we may need, especially on young females, we may need to supplement them just a little bit, but mature cows will be just fine out there. So that's a tremendous resource out there. And we have more corn stalk residue fields than we have cows. But out when you were at North Platte, boy, there was hardly ever a field that wasn't used. You move a little bit further east, right? You don't have as many cows, but we have folks from out west that are transporting cows, Kearney, Grand Island, that area, to get the corn stalks.
Yeah, it's a tremendous cheap, relative cheap, depending on where you're at, resource. And it's an interesting dynamic is in western Nebraska, 95 plus percent of corn residue is, or it's either baled or it's grazed,
Yep,
right?
yep.
And then you go east of Kearney and you start seeing that kind of decrease.
Yep.
So what's the change in mindset in from a producer standpoint that you have a high use in one side of the state and then have a not so high use in the other.
Yeah, and so the idea is that, the data would say that if you graze according to our recommendations, if you use that corn stalk grazing calculator, is that you we don't see any compaction in the field. We don't see any reduction in subsequent yield. So that was a barrier as you move further east that you had to get over, right? You had to get over that. And once they kind of saw that, they go, okay, we're good with that. Well, if you move further east, one is there are fewer cows and there's more fields, right? And so that's the reason why you see fewer of them as you move from west to east. However, if you take a look at it on years that forages, harvested forages are high priced, you see a lot more folks moving further and further east. And so basically the idea is that the increased cost of my forage, even though there's probably going to be more freight on those cows, it basically offsets or even is less when I add freight and corn stalks as compared to feeding more expensive forages. So there's more of a movement, but the other idea is we have more acres of corn as you move further east. And you have fewer cows. The other thing is you got to figure out how to water, right? That's one of the things you got to figure out. And the other thing is that folks out west are used to putting up fence, right? And if you move, in fact, around a lot of those fields, there's still a perimeter fence around a lot of those stock fields out west. As you move further east, there are less perimeter fences around those stock fields. So we'll get more cows to move east. And the other interesting thing is that is that even though they have a little bit more freight on them, typically stocks are just a little bit cheaper as you move a little bit further to the east. So, yeah, those would be the primary factors. But there's no reduction in subsequent yield.
Yeah, and I think that's an important conversation too, is that, you know, grazing corn residue does not impact the subsequent corn yields. And that was game changer for a lot of producers that was anti-grazing or thought grazing would have impaction issues and impact their corn yields following years.
Yeah, even their consultants, right? Is that you had to get to their consultants and you had to show them the data. And it's easy to blame a reduction in yield on cows where it may be something else, right?
But talking about a systems problem, right, is
yeah,
this is bigger than animal science. This is, you know, crop soil science, you know, problem. And so the UNL addressed, you know, very nicely to show there's no negative impact.
Yep.
So the last thing I want to touch on is knowing your forages. And so, you know, you've done a lot of nutrition work. I've done a lot of nutrition work. And what's the first thing you ask a producer? Do they know their forage analysis?
Yeah, do they know the quality of the forages that they have? And I think the idea, Travis, is and you've seen it, is that not all forages are average. They're not all the book value. And some of them are at book value. Some are much less than book value in regards to protein and energy, and some are much higher than book value in regards to protein and energy. And every one of our extension offices now have a forage probe. And it's ready for use by any of the producers. And, you know, it takes just a little bit of time to take a forage sample, but mm-hmm. boy, it pays dividends.
It does.
In the long run. And the idea is that at some point in time, at least in Nebraska, unless you maybe change when you calve, right, is that you're probably going to feed some forages, especially in March calving cows. And so the idea is to have a good idea what the forage quality is. And so you need a forage probe because they're not going to take a grab sample. And the other part of that is you package it and send it in, and then you got to be able to interpret the analysis.
Right.
So I would say that producers can really save a lot of money just knowing what their forages are. The idea is that when do you feed stuff that's maybe average quality? When you feed stuff that's maybe high quality, when can you put it together in a combo so that you increase the quality of the lower one and then still meet the requirements? The other thing is that the earlier you do it, the more time you have to go shopping for supplements to fill the gaps,
yep.
Right? And hopefully there's not very many gaps, but there will be some gaps. And we already talked about first calf heifers that you're probably going to have to get some kind of cube or grain or something to feed in there. But the idea is that alfalfa is a really good feed resource. Mm-hmm. It supplies energy and protein, and it's probably one of the cheaper protein sources that you have out there. So if you have that in your operation, how do you utilize that? And so take a forage sample. Make sure you have it divided into lots, right? First
yes.
cutting, second cutting, yeah. third cutting alfalfa. Early cut hay versus mid cut hay versus late cut hay, because they'll be different, right?
Yep.
And the thing is forage quality depends on three things, right? Maturity at harvest, and maturity at harvest, right? And so you think what at the earlier you harvest, right? The higher the quality, the right. later the harvest, the lower the quality. And to me, you got to figure out where that intersects for your operation, right? So I think it's a great asset. And, you know, with NIR, and then they have the libraries that they've got built in NIR. I mean, it's quick and it does a really good job.
And it's cheap too.
It's cheap, yeah. The other thing I'd say is that we feed a lot of summer annuals, and every summer annual I test for nitrates. No two ways about it, right? I just figure out what it is, where it's at. Because it's interesting is that, you know, we've had in drought years we've had them test high, and some drought years test low, and in some years where you think they wouldn't test high, they test high. And so the idea is that, and not that you can't use them, you just got to use the idea of adapt, or the solution to pollution is dilution, right? You dilute it out with some other feed. So I'd always test for nitrates on summer annuals.
But it's important to know. I had a producer call once that wanted a ration, and he said, you know, my hay is usually this. And it was like 10% crude protein and 55% TDN. I said, get it tested first. It came back 4% crude protein and 49% TDN. And that really changed the ration.
It does, man. You have to figure out how you're going to use it, right? Yep. At that point in time. And you got to think about, okay, now we need to look at what kind of supplementation strategies or what combos we need to put together now, which isn't going to be as easy, but it's doable, right? It's doable.
But in December, it creates challenges that we have to hustle to find some other method because it's such a low quality feedstuff.
Yeah, that's hard. That's hard to do. That's hard to imagine, but you know, it's you can see that more often than not, right? Sometimes, especially if you've got big delays in harvest, right? And you get some things that you just can't get up, and boy, there'd be some times where they go past peak pretty quick, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea is that it's not that difficult to get fairly low quality stuff.
Well, Rick, to wrap us up, you want to touch on anything that we left off, or are so one last remaining comment, suggestion for beef producers?
Yeah, I just think the idea is how can you manage, what can you do to limit number of open cows?
Yeah.
And how can you do it economically? Because you and I both know we can overfeed them and probably reduce the number of open cows. But we also know that the biggest cost in the cow-calf enterprise is feed costs. So what's that balance look like, right? You don't have to be 100% pregnant, but you sure enough want to be in them 90s, right? Somewhere in there. And so that's the idea, is that how can I manage open cows? Because if they're not pregnant, it's a drag on the system. The other thing is that how can I manage that postpartum interval, right? Mm-hmm. That how can I manage the time that they calve to the time that they start their ester cycle after calving? Because that's going to tell you how well you maintain a 365-day calving interval.
Right?
So those are the kinds of things I'd have you think about. And it relates back primarily to nutrition, you know? And the other thing is, I think you got to think about, you know, cows and the advantage of crossbred cows and that kind of thing. So you need to keep that in mind as you think about how to limit the number of open cows.
No, that's a great comment of understanding. It's not about overall preg rate. It's the combination of my cost to get to that preg rate. And then crossbreeding is such a good tool that we don't utilize enough.
Yeah, you don't need it all, but you need some.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Well, Rick, thanks for jumping on. Really enjoyed catching up and talking to you about body condition score, nutrition, and managing cows.
This has been really a lot of fun, Travis. Thanks a lot.
It's time for our famous three.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virvac's new Bovigen Platinum Vaccines. These four vaccines deliver quality protection against respiratory and reproductive diseases in the vaccine combinations you need to protect cattle at every life stage. Bovigen Platinum vaccines are comprehensive and safe, have consistent supply made in the United States, and are backed by a 6-month guarantee in the Bovigen Platinum Protection Program. Start your platinum protection at us.virvac.com/platinum protection or contact your Virvac representative.
And so I've got three optional questions here. And so the first one is, what is your recommended beef resource, that website, book that you recommend beef producers utilizing?
Yeah. So I recommend beef.unl.edu. You know, I mean, even though it's at the University of Nebraska, there's a lot of good stuff on there. And you've been part of populating that, and we appreciate that, but it's a pretty good resource. The other thing is that there's some learning modules on there, Travis. And we talked about body condition, we talk about sampling, we talk about how do you find the best buy on a protein supplement or an energy supplement.
Right.
Those kinds of things are there available. The other thing is, it has our beef report on there. And so if you want to keep up to date with what's going on in Nebraska in regards to research, and you've got some stuff in the 2025 beef report from when you were here at Nebraska, that's a good website. And that you can grab a lot of research information off there as well.
And not to give you a big head, but, you know, you getting that website up and running early on in your career, what was, you know, it's one of the best, actually, extension beef resources online.
And yeah, I appreciate that. And there's a lot of folks like yourself that have contributed to that. And so, yeah, even though we got it up and running, I remember somebody came into me and says, man, we need to get on this platform. And I turned around and says, well, back then, I says, I think maybe 25% of my beef producers have a computer. And less than that have internet access.
Right.
But the idea is that we jumped ahead of the game, and a lot of people bought in on the faculty, and it worked out really good.
No, it was great. So what is a non-beef related book that you highly recommend someone reading?
Yeah, I think this is one that's really good. It's the idea of a start with why.
Yes, yeah.
And this is a really good book, and I know we don't have a lot of time to read stuff, but boy, the idea is that if you understand what your why is, mm-hmm. and that can be for yourself, and it can be for your operation, it could be for your family, but the idea is that they go through a lot of stuff that I think is really important, not only for you as a person, but for the kinds of things that we do in the ag business as well.
Oh, that's great. Lastly, what sets apart, in your opinion, a successful beef professional?
Yeah, that's a tough one. But I would say that ones that that separate themselves is they have a passion for the industry. Mm-hmm. The other part of it is that they surround themselves with good people. They have a really good network. And then third is I think they take time for capacity building. And so they go to some meetings. They don't go to a lot of meetings. They go to some meetings. They listen to podcasts like this. They're diligent at readers. And so those would be the three things that I think separate the ones that I have a respect for all producers, but those are the ones I think kind of separate themselves out. And the other thing is they also take time. They take time to retool, mm-hmm. and they take time to, if they have families, they take time for the family as well. So it's not all about working hard, although our industry, it's about working hard. And but there's some times where you don't have to work as hard, if you will, and just take some time to kind of retool things.
That's a great response. So, well, Rick, thanks for jumping on. Enjoyed it. This has been a good podcast.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for asking me, Travis.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.